I want to be doing today. So let me start by explaining market failure. And I apologize to those of you who've heard this story before, but it's my favorite example. It's about 1,000 years ago. And you are one of a long line of 1,000 men with spears standing on foot pointing your spears that way. And the reason you're pointing your spears that way is that that dust cloud in the distance is 1,000 or so men on horseback with spears coming straight at you. And you make a very rapid cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if all of us stand and keep our spears in position, with luck we'll break their charge. And if we break their charge, some of us will die, but most of us will live. On the other hand, if we run away, horses run faster than we do. Obviously, I should stand. Oops, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him, I just control me. If all of them stand and I run, I'm not going to be the one of the ones who might get killed stopping their charge. If all of them run and I stand, my chances of surviving this encounter are very low. Whatever the other people are going to do, I am better off running. If they're going to run, if I run, I might get to the head of the crowd and maybe I'll get away. Whereas if I stand, I'm dead. If they're going to stand, well, that's very brave and heroic of them. Fine opportunity for me to get away. So all of us rationally run and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right. In my view, what I have just described is the essential nature of market failure. That what market failure is a situation where rational behavior by individuals does not lead, as it were, to rational behavior by the group. Why is it happening in this case and in lots of others? Because when I run, I make myself better off and all of them worse off. When each of them runs, he makes himself better on all the rest of us worse off. Add it up, and all of us running is worse for all of us than all of us standing, but each of us controls only his own behavior and correctly concludes that he is better running than standing. Many of you at some point in school have probably been introduced to the prisoner's dilemma. I won't go through the details, but it's a case where basically it's in the interest of each of two prisoners accused of a joint crime to confess in exchange for a lighter sentence, when if both of them kept their mouths shut, they'd both be better off. But each one knows that the way the game has been set up, if the other guy confesses, he will do better to confess. If the other guy doesn't confess, he will do better to confess, because then he'll get a reward for handing in the other guy, basically. Right. So another standard example is coal fires in London in the late 19th century. Coal produces some unattractive effluence when it burns. Everybody might be better off if they used less coal or found some other way of heating their houses, but each person correctly calculates that his coal furnace, his coal fire, will only have a very, very small adverse effect on the London fog, and it'll keep him warm. So each person rationally does it, even though they're all worse off. And you can all see how a lot of the arguments that are made for government intervention really hinge on effects of this sort: global warming, air pollution, and so forth. A lot of others hinge on bad arguments of this sort, but not all of them. One point worth noting before we go on, though, is that whether you get market failure sometimes depends on the particular rules of the game, which means that if you're constructing institutions, if you're designing laws or structuring a corporation, one of the things you want to think about is how do I set up the rules so that individual rationality will lead to group rationality? That individual rationality is the tool we've got available. How can I set things up so that each person bears the costs of his own actions? My favorite story here, again, some of you may have heard it before, is the story of the camel race. That two Bedouins are riding their camels through the desert with the oasis a couple of miles ahead of them, and one of them starts complaining about how his camel has got to be the slowest camel in all the deserts of Arabia. And the other one says, "You think your camel is slow? Let me tell you about this foot-dragging son of a jinn that I'm trying to ride." And they get into an argument about whose camel is worse. And they decide to settle it with a bet. And they agree that whoever's camel gets last to the oasis wins the bet, and the other one has to pay him a golden dinar. And if you think about the logic of this game, you can see that it's rather perverse. Because one of them goes slow, and the other goes slower, and the other goes slower still, trying to win the bet. And the result is that an hour and a half later, two Bedouin are sitting their camels stock still in the blazing sun with the oasis still a mile away. And at this point, a wise holy man comes by, and he says, "What are you two idiots doing, sitting your camels stock still in the blazing sun a mile from the oasis?" And they get off their camels to explain the bet to him and the problem they've gotten into. And he whispers two words to them, and they leap onto the camels and ride off to the oasis as fast as possible. Can somebody who hasn't heard this before tell me what the two words are? Switch camels. The bet was on which camel got last, so we've just reversed the incentive. So that's a nice little pocket example of how you switch from market failure, which economists might also call incentive incompatibility, to incentive compatibility by a small tweak in the rules of the game. And that's one of the reasons why, putting aside all political arguments, thinking in terms of market failure is useful, because you can say, how can I arrange whatever I'm arranging to minimize this sort of problem? Why is it that market failure is so commonly thought of as an argument against laissez-faire capitalism? And I think the answer is that economists, at least, generally assume that individuals are rational. I would say, to me at least, the definition of economics is it's that approach to understanding behavior that starts from the assumption that individuals act rationally, individuals have goals and act rationally to achieve them. And what rationally means to an economist is not they set up an Excel spreadsheet for every minor decision, but in some average sense, they tend to take the actions that best achieve their goal, however they figure out how to do it. I like to argue that cats are rational and babies are rational too. I don't know if any of you have ever had a cat as a roommate, but if so, you may have done the experiment in the morning of reading the newspaper when you should have been petting the cat. And the cat has a very simple solution to this. It lies down on the newspaper. And since cats are opaque, you now take your second best alternative and pet the cat like you're supposed to. I don't think cats understand what newspapers are. So it isn't rational in the sense of having figured it out. I assume this is a result of trial and error. But it worked. And having worked, it gets repeated. And similarly, babies are rational. One or two of you may actually have been babies at some point in the past. If not, just imagine the situation as, say, a one-month or two-month-old baby. You're in a world, you would like to control it to make it pleasanter, and you have very limited tools. You can't control your hands and your feet yet. You have only one effective tool, and that's your voice. So when things are bad, when you're wet or hungry, you make loud, unpleasant noises, and big people come and fix the problem. That's rational behavior, given the constraints of the tools available to you. All right, so given that economists assume people are rational, it's tempting, especially for libertarians, to say we're all rational, so therefore we'll always end up doing the right thing, right? And then market failure shows why that's too quick an answer. And there are a number of sort of standard examples. I might as well run through them. What is a public good to an economist? A public good is a good with two characteristics of which I would argue only one is essential. The inessential one is that my consuming it doesn't keep you from consuming it. That it's non-rivalrous is the technical term. Think about a radio broadcast. It's no harder for you to listen to it if I'm listening to it. So the other one, which I think is essential, is that it's non-excludable. That the person who is producing the public good can't control who gets it. The way I usually put it is, if produced at all, it will be available to all the members of some pre-existing group of people, such as all the people living within a certain distance of your broadcasting antenna. And it's clear that the fact that it's a public good raises problems for private production. Because the normal way you pay for producing goods is you say to each customer, if you want it, you've got to pay me. If you don't pay me, I won't give it to you. In the case of the public good, you can't do that. Because you can't control who gets it. On the other hand, we observe that a fair number of public goods are produced privately. Indeed, I would like to believe that at this very instant, I am producing a public good. That raising the knowledge among libertarians of certain economic ideas has some very small but hopefully positive effect on the condition of the world in the future. I will be able to capture a little bit of that effect for myself, but most of it will go to other people. And I can't exclude, I can't control who benefits from the increased wisdom I am hopefully spreading at the moment. All right. For a somewhat less personal example, a radio broadcast is pretty much a classic example of a public good, and yet in the U.S. they're produced privately. How are they produced privately? Some unknown to me genius thought of the idea of producing not one public good, but two. One of them has a positive production cost and a positive value to the consumer, and it is called a radio program, and one of them has a negative production cost and a negative value to the consumer, and it's called an advertisement. You tie them tightly together and produce them both, and now the negative cost of production, meaning that people will pay you to put on the ads, covers the positive cost of producing the other. So that's one example, but there are many other examples where an ingenious person can find a way of privately producing a public good. And similarly, lots of the things the government produces are private goods. Mail delivery, the post office could choose not to carry your letter, and does if you don't have a stamp on it. So it's not defined as something produced by government, although I think one can say the fact something is a public good is at least some argument that the market won't produce it, and therefore some argument for government production. Another standard example of market failure, what I've mentioned already, is externalities. I take an action which imposes costs on other people. If it's just one other person, he can sue me, or we can have a legal system which says I'm not allowed to do it without his permission. But if you think about a case like air pollution, it's very hard to make that kind of mechanism work. So when I decide how much steel to produce and whether to use high sulfur or low sulfur coal in a straight laissez-faire system, I ignore the highly dispersed costs imposed on other people. I could go into more detailed discussion, but it's good enough for my present purposes. And therefore, I use the high sulfur coal, even if the more expensive low sulfur coal would save more in pollution costs than it would cost me to put it on. And you can think of other examples of that sort. And again, you can sometimes solve those. There's a case that's quite famous in the literature because it's a case of an economist getting it wrong. There's a famous piece by Ronald Coase, which if people are curious, go to my webpage and you can find my explanation of it, in which he suggested that as long as transaction costs are low enough, externalities can always be dealt with by contract, because the people who are downwind from me will pay me to use the low sulfur coal. Or if the legal rule says I can't pollute them, then if the low sulfur coal is a lot cheaper, a lot more expensive, I will pay the people downwind for permission. That's a very, very brief summary of one part of Coase's argument. And an economist called Mead wrote, actually a little before Coase wrote, saying, in theory you might be able to solve problems in this way, but clearly it's not practical. Look at the case of bees and honey. That bees benefit from browsing on crops that produce nectar, they turn into honey. And yet how could you expect bees to see the no trespassing sign and not fly over a flower unless the owner of the hive had bought permission, had rented the use of that field? And there was a wonderful article written some years later called The Fable of the Bees, which demonstrated that contractual solutions to this problem had been going for as long as we had data on the industry, which was about 100 years. That in fact, bees do not recognize no trespassing signs, but like the rest of us, they're lazy, and they prefer to gather their nectar as close as they can to the hive. So when the flowers are providing nectar, the owners of the apiarists, the owners of the bees, pay the farmers for permission to put their hives in their fields. When the crops need pollination, it turns out that in fact it's a double externality, it goes both directions, now the farmers pay the apiarists to put their bees in the field. So it's sort of a neat example where the real world market in fact had solved an externality problem, and the economists just assumed it couldn't possibly be done. And although all of these examples suggest that you will sometimes succeed in getting public goods produced privately and getting externalities privately taken account of, none of them give you any guarantee that the market will solve such problems. And they therefore imply that we ought to expect that under laissez-faire capitalism, there will be some things worth producing that aren't produced. there will be some things produced in a more costly way if you take account of cost to everybody than they could be, all as a result of individual rationality failing to lead to group rationality. All right, that's the argument against the market from the standpoint of I'm reading this off my cell phone, which is what I've got my outline on, and for some reason it just decided not to scroll for me. But I can manage anyway. I have a backup. I also have a laptop, which has the same information on it. But this is cuter. Oops. Anyway, so when and if it decides to behave, now it's behaving itself. All right. I can close this one down. So anyway, what I want to argue, however, is that while this is indeed all true about the market, it is true and indeed much more true about the political market. That the alternative to having decisions made in the laissez-faire mechanism with private property and each person using his own stuff is some other way of making decisions. And as a practical matter, the normal alternative we're looking at is the alternative of having governments make decisions. So let's think about market failure on the political market. And I want to start out with the question of why anybody would expect democracy to work. All right, there is what I think of as the civic class model of democracy, or the naive model of democracy. And that says, well, why does it work? Because the voters want good things. The voters want good outcomes. The voters, therefore, vote for politicians who do good things. They vote against politicians who do bad things. Thus, we get politicians in whose rational self-interest it is to do good things to get elected. That's, I think, the sort of simple model of democracy. The problem with that is that knowing whether a politician is doing good things is not a costless activity. That oddly enough, politicians almost never run explaining who they have hurt in their last term. There have been many farm bills introduced to Congress, but none of them started out a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. All right, although that's the purpose of almost all farm bills, one of the purposes. I'm pretty sure that nowhere in the gigantic cap and trade bill did it say one of the purposes of this bill is to increase world hunger by turning food crops into fuel, which is one of the things that that bill passed would do. So what that tells you is that in order for the civics class model to work, the individual voter has to do a lot of time and effort in order to have some halfway decent idea of whether the things that all the politicians said were good were actually good or bad. Why should he do that? Well, if I engage in that effort, I will increase in a presidential election, perhaps by as much as one chance in 10 million, the probability that the right guy gets elected. That's not a very large payoff. Now, it's true that if I increase by 1 in 10 million the chance the right guy is getting elected, if right guy means good for the country, not just good for me, then I've produced a benefit for 300 million people. So one chance in 10 million of helping 300 million, that's not a bad payoff. But I don't get that. I only get one person's worth. Maybe a couple if I really care about, you know, those near and dear to me. But the information needed to make democracy work is a public good. Collecting that information produces a benefit for everybody in the polity where I'm voting, of which I get a negligible fraction. So that means that the rational voter will be rationally ignorant, unless it might be his hobby as politics. I mean, people can do it for entertainment, but if you think of sort of the ordinary voter, he will rationally be ignorant of what politicians have done, will do, what policies are good or bad. He will vote on some basis of what makes him feel good, of what will make his neighbors like him because he wants to conform to their views of virtue and vice and so forth and so on. So very hard to see how the civics class model can work if the voters don't know who are the good guys and the bad guys, what are the good policies and the bad policies. And that actually suggests a second and much more realistic model of democracy, and one which again gets us to a public good problem, but a different one. And that's, think about special interest lobbying. All right? I'm a member of an interest group. Let us say a steel industry. I'm a stockholder or a worker in the steel industry. And I would like to have a tariff on the import of steel so that my steel company will do better. Or I'll get a bigger salary if I'm an employee. And a tariff on, if there is a tariff on steel, that will benefit not just me, but everybody else in my situation. But there are organizations that exist to pool the interests of a bunch of us. They're called steel firms and the Steelworkers Union. So that means it's true that the tariff is itself a public good. It's a public good for the particular public consisting of people in the steel industry. So raising money to buy the tariff, raising political contributions to offer to politicians who will support the tariff, is a public good problem. But it's a public good problem with a very small public, namely the steel firms and the union, and with very small publics, contractual solutions to the public good problem, where you say, I'll contribute if you contribute, are reasonably workable. Stopping the tariff is also a public good problem, because everyone except the steel industry is hurt by the tariff. Slight exaggeration, but not very much. But the set of people who are hurt by the tariff consists of roughly 298 million dispersed people, not represented by any particular organization. Many of them are members of other organizations, but they aren't unified by being steel customers. So the result is that if the steel tariff benefits the industry by $100 million and hurts the customer by $300 million, the industry will raise, say, 10% of its $100 million and offer $10 million to buy the tariff. The customers will offer a tenth of a percent of their $300 million, and that'll be $300,000 to stop it, and the tariff will pass. And, of course, tariffs do pass, even though economists have known for about 200 years that, as a general rule, a tariff hurts the country that imposes it. So that's an interesting case where what you're getting is inefficient laws from an economist standpoint, laws that hurt the victims more than they help the beneficiaries, but they are passed because the beneficiaries are a concentrated interest group and the victims are a dispersed interest group. Right? So that's another case where the public good problem, in effect, torpedoes the working of the political system once in the naive version, and a second time in the sophisticated version, which says, well, yes, it's interest groups, but the interest groups represent people's benefits, and if a group is willing to bid more for this than against it, that shows it's good. It doesn't show it's good unless the two groups are equally concentrated. All right? Let me give you an entirely different case, but one that's also important. And this has to do with the question of how in a market, and I'm going to include political markets as well as laissez-faire markets, how in a market you engage in long-term investments. All right? Suppose you think that there is a market for black walnut timber, very pretty wood. The problem is that they're slow-growing trees. It's going to take 50 years for walnut trees to grow. And you're 60 years old. So somebody might say it can't pay you to plant a field full of black walnuts because you'll never live to harvest them. But that's wrong. I don't have to live to harvest them. When I'm 80, I sell that field to somebody else, pointing out to him that it will be mature in only 30 years, whereas if he planted afresh, he'd have 50 years to wait. In another 20 years, he can sell it to someone else. So what that tells you is that you can have planning in an ordinary market setting well beyond the individual lifetime due to the ability to transfer the thing from one person to another. There is, however, a critical assumption that I'm making implicitly, and that's secure property rights. If there is a significant chance each year either that the government will decide that black walnut trees are a national treasure and belong to the government and seize my property, or if some enterprising individual will decide, say around the 49th year, that that tree is really ready for harvesting and it's a nice dark moonless night and he's got a pickup truck and a chainsaw and come in and privatize, as it were, my walnut trees into his pickup truck. In any of those cases, people won't make the long run investment unless it's very, very profitable because the risk of losing it is too high. One of the problems with the political marketplace is that politicians have insecure property rights. The way I used to put it a couple of administrations ago is Clinton could rent out the White House, but he couldn't sell it. And the fact that politicians have insecure property rights means it's in their interest to heavily discount future costs and benefits as opposed to short-term costs and benefits. Now, that's reinforced by the rational ignorance problem, because it's much easier to lie to people about the future than about the present, because they can't see it. In my view, that's the history of the Soviet Union. that each year Stalin told his people, yes, things are hard. Yes, you're suffering. But it's to build a future in which your children will be richer than the Americans. He was lying. But it was a sensible lie for him to make because the people who were listening could see that they were hungry and cold and couldn't see what was going to happen in the future. But even without that, as long as the voters are simply ignorant, you would expect that politicians would be concerned with payoffs, costs, and benefits during their term, not with ones that will occur to the successor and his successor and so forth. So that's why, despite all the talk about capitalism being short-sighted, in fact, if you look out in the real world, you observe that the political concern is almost always with the state of the economy at the next election. Very little, except for propaganda, about really long-term consequences. So what all of these arguments suggest, and what I think is in fact true, is that while it is indeed true that market failure is a real problem on the private market, it is a bigger problem on the political market. That the way I like to put it is that the market failure problem is the exception on the private market and the rule on the public market. Because in the political market, where is it coming from? It's ultimately, go back to that line of soldiers, it's ultimately coming from the fact that I am either not getting the benefits or not paying the cost of my actions. Almost all political decisions have that characteristic. Somebody makes a decision and other people get the benefits and or pay the costs. So therefore it is not surprising that the market failure problem coming from that is essentially a normal situation. Or to put it differently, that on the private market we have reasons to expect individual rationality to produce group rationality, but there are exceptions. In the public market we don't have those reasons. So that's the sense in which it seems to me that it makes sense to think of market failure as fundamentally an argument against government, not an argument for government. Now, I don't want to discuss here the question of how far you can carry that result. I'm going to be part of an anarchy versus limited government discussion tomorrow. But it seems to me that the same arguments apply at every level. There's no reason to expect the government to make good laws any more than to expect it to make good automobiles or do a good job of growing food. One conclusion that this suggests is that if you think of market failure as sort of a scientific theory, as a way of explaining the world, it is a better way of explaining the political part of the world than the private part of the world. That if you just do the market failure analysis without looking at the facts, you conclude that there is no private radio industry. That's a pure public good with a big public. And yet, oddly enough, there is a private radio industry. On the other hand, suppose you apply the same analysis to farm policy across countries. All right? Gary Becker, a long time ago, made the following observation, which I think is almost true. I know of one exception. And that is that the world is divided into two kinds of countries for purposes of farm policy. There are countries where the farmers are a small minority of the population, like the U.S. and Europe. And in those countries, farm policy exists to benefit farmers at the expense of the mass of the population. Why? Because a small group is a relatively concentrated organized interest group. That's what the market failure analysis of political interest groups tells you. Then there are countries where the farmers are a very large, basically poor peasant countries. In those countries, the purpose of farm policy is to drive down the price of agricultural products in order to buy the support of the urban mob at the expense of the dispersed and politically impotent peasantry. Now, I believe the only exception I know of is New Zealand, where as far as I can tell from asking people when I was there a few years ago, it neither tries to drive the price of agricultural products up or down. It's an interesting country because in some ways it's more socialist than the U.S. In other ways it's less socialist. I believe that there are no restrictions on who can drive a taxi cab in New Zealand. I mean, you probably have to get a driver's license, but you can. And I think I was told that they don't even set the fares of cabs, that you could set your own fares. So in some ways it's more free enterprise, in some ways less. Let me go on to suggest that, go on aside from the political stuff to make the more general point of using market failure as a way of thinking about problems in the world. And let me start with an example that at least some of you are probably familiar with, and that is you have two people sharing a household, a husband and wife, roommates, lovers, doesn't much matter. Both of whom can cook and both of whom can wash dishes. And they feel like sort of sharing responsibilities, and there are two obvious models. One model is that today I cook and you wash up, tomorrow you cook and I wash up. And the other model is today I cook and wash up, tomorrow you cook and wash up. And they are both equally fair, egalitarian, and the question is there any reason to choose between them? Suggestions? Any preference? Well, then you'd always do it. I'm taking a case where it's even enough so that you want to divide it, and the question is, do you have the person who cooks the meal clean up from that meal, or do you take it off? There's an obvious argument for the switching arrangement, and that is that you're sort of tired after cooking. But I want to claim there's another and more powerful argument in the opposite direction.
Moral hazard argument.
That's
if you do both today, you have an incentive basically to skip town the next day.
Oh, well, you're skipping. It's a moral hazard problem, but that's not it, yeah? Those of you who actually cook know that how much of a mess you make is not a fixed thing independent of your choices. All right? You can choose to use a clean pan every time, or you can say, well, while the water is coming to a boil, I'll rinse out the frying pan so I can use it again. You can choose to do everything in a different bowl and throw them together, or you can sort of put in some more here and some more here. You can think that there are a whole lot of choices, and when you're cooking, for most things you cook, there are spaces of blank time of, you know, a minute or 5 minutes or 10 minutes when you could be cleaning up from the previous stage. But why should you do that if somebody else is going to clean up for you? So the claim I want to make, at least, is that the strong argument for the rule in which the person who makes the mess cleans it up, which you can generalize beyond cooking, is that it gives people an incentive to restrict the messes they make. And that's a case of engineering around market failure. And those of you who are parents have probably thought of a very analogous case with regard to child rearing, that your small child makes a mess. It's clear not only that you could clean up the mess much faster than he could, it would probably be less work for you to clean up the mess than to get him to clean up the mess. You still get him to clean up the mess. Because he then bears the cost of the mess, and he then has a reason to learn not to make messes. So these are all the same argument in different, slightly different forms. Let me give you a different one, and this is one of my many unpatented and uncreated inventions, and it has to do with a problem that professors routinely face in class, which I call the silent student problem. And the problem is that at some point in my lecture, after giving a brilliantly clear explanation of some important point, which I may mention I have explained 300 times before in other classes, I turn to my students and I say, now, did everybody follow that? And no one says anything. And since no one says anything, obviously they all followed it. And so I go on to the next point and discover my mistake only when I grade the exam. All right. What is happening? That, in fact, almost nobody followed it. Each student did not want to look stupid to me. It might even lower his grade if knowledge in class matters. It might lower his status with the other students. So each one stayed quiet and did not explain they didn't get it. Well, I have a solution to this problem. And it turns out that at this point, though not when I offered the solution, the technology is actually out there, although I don't know if anybody's using it for this purpose. But my solution was that you arrange your classroom so that at every seat there's a little button by people's feet which they can unobtrusively push or not push as they like. And at the back of the classroom there is a big sign which shows how many buttons are pushed. And so when I come to this point, when it's perfectly clear to me that it's perfectly clear to them that they understand what I say, I said, now, will everybody who thinks he clearly followed that, please push your button. And the number 2 appears on the sign, and I go back and do it over again. All right. So that would be another example of dealing with a problem of this sort by, in effect, re-engineering the set of rules of the game. Suppose you were designing a firm. I have no experience with this. I am not, in fact, an entrepreneur in that sense. I admire and grateful to people who create firms that produce nice things that I can use, but it's not what I do. But you want to think a whole lot about how you design the firm so that the people within it have the right incentives. And sort of one obvious point is, if it's a big firm, it doesn't do a lot of good to say your bonus depends on the profits the firm made this year, because the individual will know that his efforts have only a tiny effect, just like voting, on the profits of the firm, and the benefit will mostly go to other people. But if you can set up profit centers, if you can somehow design your accounting so that you can isolate the part of the firm's profit closely linked to a particular employee's efforts, now it makes sense to try to set up a reward structure. And of course, things like salesman's commissions are ways of trying to do that. So that's a general attempt to achieve this. Let me tell you my other favorite story on this subject, along with my camels. But this is again an incentive compatibility story. From a little over 100 years ago, Jose robbed a bank in Texas and fled south across the Rio Grande with the Texas Rangers in hot pursuit. And they caught up with him in a little town in Old Mexico, only to discover that Jose spoke no English and none of them spoke any Spanish. I'm not sure that's very likely at the time, but suppose it for my purposes. So they draft the local school teacher who speaks English to act as translator. And the Rangers, having captured Jose, say to the school teacher, ask Jose where he has hidden the money. And the school teacher says to Jose, the gringos want to know where you have hidden the money. Tell the gringos I will never tell them. Jose says he will never tell you. The Rangers draw out their six guns, cock them, point them at Jose's head. If you do not tell us, we will kill you. The gringos say, if you do not tell them, they will kill you. Jose begins to shake with fear. I buried it by the oak tree down by the river. Jose says he's not afraid to die. All right. That's a problem of what economists call incentive compatibility. The Rangers blew it because they thought of the school teacher as a machine, not as a person. They forgot that he has his own objectives, just like all the rest of us. And that's a mistake made routinely, especially by governments, but not only by governments, in organizational design. Notice that throughout this discussion, I am making the same behavioral assumptions about everybody. I am making the same assumptions about individual soldiers 1,000 years ago, about students, about politicians, about voters. It's not that there are good guys and bad guys. It's that everybody, I assume, to be rationally self-interested. Self-interested doesn't mean selfish. It doesn't mean that all you care about is your own material welfare. Obviously, I care about, you know, things like the welfare of my wife and my children and my grandson, and lots of other things as well. I mean, I care about feeling that I have contributed to the stock of true ideas in economics. But I don't care about everything. And in particular, my set of things I care about is very unlikely to be the same as yours. All right. So each person is self-interested in that he has his own set of objectives, and he is taking those actions that best achieve those objectives. And I assume that's true for everybody, for the saint as well as for the sinner. They just may have different objectives, and that model then can be generalized, and people act that way. I think that really covers what I wanted to say, so why don't I now throw it open to questions? I figured out a long time ago the one great advantage of answering a question is that you can be pretty sure there's at least one person in the audience who's interested in what you're talking about. Questions? Way back.
All right. So you have this argument that essentially rational rationality leads to has a crazy public goods problem. You know, also it's the, you know, distributional, like special interest versus dispersed interest as an argument against government. But isn't that better raised as an argument against democracy, essentially democratic decision making, not necessarily against all of the government?
That's an interesting question. It's not clear there are better systems. Now, you could argue that there are systems that have more secure property rights. In particular, a really well set up hereditary monarchy not only is the politician pretty sure he'll be there for life, but people care about their kids and his kids will be there for their lives too. So in that particular problem you might take care of. But I think the basic public good part of it, I think, is going to apply to almost any system. Because despite the sort of romantic idea of the dictator as the strong guy who can push everybody, there aren't any dictators who can push everybody around. All right? Any dictator can be killed by 10 guys, if they're the right 10 guys. Probably fewer than 10 guys. So in that sense, I think all systems, whether or not they're formally democratic, depend on support of various sorts. And whether that support is people who are willing to fight for you, or people who are willing to donate you money, or people who are willing to give you information, things of that sort. So I think that certainly the analysis would not be identical for a non-democratic system, but it seems to me that the general problem of how you use political mechanisms is not, as far as I know, a solved problem. I don't know of any way of setting up political mechanisms, in the normal sense of political, which would not result in large numbers of market failure problems of this sort. Notice that it's not that market failure creates a public good problem. It is rather that the public good is a particular example of something that creates a market failure problem. Right? The fact that the public good would be true even if it worked, even in the case of the radio broadcast. Another question? Yes. Yeah. You might also note that it's a reason to reject the assumption that everybody in Guantanamo is guilty. Because the version of that story that's immediately relevant is you go into Afghanistan, you've got a translator, but you don't really have any local knowledge, and you say, if you can find some Taliban, we'll pay you money for them. All right? There's no particular reason to expect that many of the people turned over to you will be Taliban. So that would be another nice example. Questions? Yes.
Not really a question. I sort of shot it down for making a statement. But anyway, here's a story that you might add to your pot and pan kitchen tale. Two members of the political, this is a true story, two members of the political science department at Hawaii decided, because of housing costs, that they would buy a house together, two couples. And they all four of them live in this house peacefully because they're socialists. Hard left socialists. And everything was going to be empty door. Guess how long it took before they broke up and sold the house?
Years.
But they ceased to be friends. They had to break up everything and move into their own separate quarters. But they're still socialists. Now, that's really like, why did they remain socialists after having learned firsthand all the irrationality of socialist
Well, part of a legitimate answer they could make is this is a single experiment with a particular institutional structure, and maybe if we had done it better, that they could, after all, point out to various traditional voluntary communes that have existed for long periods of time. If you think about a monastery, kibbutzim in Israel, and so forth, so that it's not as if you can never make small group common ownership systems work. It's just they raise a set of serious problems. And as long as it's voluntary, if the problems get too big, you get the outcome, it breaks up again. And if people manage to solve it, fine, they can be happy with that way of doing it. I mean, after all, I have common property with my wife, and that's worked pretty smoothly for the last few decades. So it's not as if... I mean, there's a real sense in which a family is a socialist or maybe better communist institution, most families at least, in the sense that most of the property de facto is controlled by several people, is usual by several people, with some kinds of agreements to reach decision making. And some families are dictatorships by the father or by the mother. Other families are much more consensual.
Well, political science professors are long-winded, but I thought of their answer within that detail.
That I don't know.
I'm wondering if you could apply some of your discussion directly to the United States Congress, and I want you to clarify something for me in your mind. I'm thinking about the differences between the Senate and the House of Representatives, and I assume because of the Senate, the 6-year tenure of U.S. Senate, that this market failure problem is less likely to occur.
The particular problem associated with insecure property rights is less likely. You would expect senators to worry. A newly elected senator is going to worry about a program that looks good for 4 years and then blows up in the fifth year. Newly elected representative worries a bit because, after all, incumbents usually win. So I don't want to exaggerate the difference that the representative will probably still be in 6 years, but he's not as sure as the senator is. Yeah.
And along those lines, I'm also assuming that some sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Term limit would increase the problem, that particular problem, rather than.
That's right. That particular problem, I agree, would be increased by a term limit. Because it would mean that the property rights were even less secure. And just as I said, that particular problem you solve with hereditary monarchy.
Now, the final part of that, I'm sorry to yep. hog the question here, is the public good problem. Do you think that's more of an issue in the House or the Senate, and why?
I don't see why it would be in either case, because in either case, the public good in question isn't the politicians,
right.
It's the interest group out there. And
the impact.
And the interest, yeah. I don't see any, maybe if I thought about it more, I would think of a better answer, but I don't see any obvious reason why it would. Yeah.
I'd like to know, what do you think about the notion that every problem is a market? The micro example would be, if I look around and I think, what are my problems and what are other people's problems? How could I help to solve those problems and make profit? At the macro level, Latvia might look at the United States and say, look at that, they've got this overburdening tax code and other problems. What can we do to attract more American expatriates?
That is, to some extent, you're saying governments compete for people. Yeah, I mean, as you may know, my son has got a project to make them do that a little bit more called seasteading, in which the idea is that if you... Now, I want to say I think the odds it will succeed are well below even, but it's worth making long bets sometimes, and if it does succeed, it could do a lot of good. Yeah, no, there is some degree of competition among governments that when I spent the one summer in Washington I've ever spent, one of the sort of things people thought they were against was, quote, tax competition. And what does tax competition mean? It means states and localities offering lower taxes, either special case for one firm or more generally to attract firms. And of course my response is I thought competition was a good thing if the tax money is being used to produce things that the firm values more than the money, then you won't offer lower taxes. You'll have the higher taxes and the good schools that their employees want their kids to go to. It's only if you're charging them $10 for $5 worth of benefit or maybe no benefit that you could expect the competition to mess it up. So there's certainly some of that, and that's one argument for a federal system, of course. But on the other hand, people aren't very mobile, especially as mobile at the distance of across, not that mobile across states, and we've got a federal government messing it up too, and not very mobile across countries, especially when you've got different languages. And one interesting question, which I have thought about, is how technology will change this. Because the more of your life is lived online, in a sense, the more mobile you are. That I could, a few years ago, go off to spend 2 weeks in Paris and continue the conversations I've been having in San Jose. Because they were conversations on Usenet, conducted over the internet, doesn't matter where I am. And in fact, one of the things which may have made my daughter's first year at college less successful socially than it otherwise might have been is she didn't have to take all the risks of trying to make friends among her college fellow students because she had friends online and she took them with her. Now, if as that technology develops, if we end up in a world where, as a practical matter, 90% of your life is lived in virtual reality online, including your work and much of your social life, now moving to Latvia isn't such a wrench, and now you will have more effective competition among governments. Yeah. Other people? Yeah. Yes.
Well, you being a man of words, there's a word that I've been wanting a good definition of because it's been thrown around an awful lot the last year, and it seems to belong to whoever yells it first at the other group, and that's the fascist. what exactly separates that from the other?
I would have said that in current political discourse, fascist means somebody I disagree with. Strongly disagree. I think there is a legitimate meaning to it, that fascism really was a sort of an economic and political ideology, and that the economic part of it was basically private ownership and government control. That you had firms nominally in private hands, the private owners could collect profits, but to a large extent the decisions of the firms were dictated by what the government told them to do. And I think that describes the economy of Nazi Germany, to a considerable extent of fascist Italy and so forth. And it seemed... I think that the elements of the things libertarians don't like, some of them you could describe as socialism, such as the public school system, and some of them you could describe as fascism, such as the various interventions associated with the financial system. But I probably wouldn't advise you to call them fascism, because as a practical matter, that word has lost real content. That it really, as I say, means somebody you really don't disagree with strongly. And calling people names isn't very useful, and not enough people will actually have the reference to see in what sense it's a real argument. Yeah?
I'm wondering how you might think of the current problem of newspapers, where their product is paid for by some advertisers and paid for by some buyers and subscribers, but as soon as it's printed, goes through another distribution channel where it's available for free,
yeah.
And so that, in effect, much of the profitability is appropriated by somebody unrelated to that.
As you may know, this is actually an old legal problem, much older than the internet. Which was really on to what extent one newspaper was entitled to reprint news they had gotten from another newspaper. And it's clear that there is a problem of insecure property rights and information. It's also clear that it's extremely hard to define and enforce property rights and information. And it may therefore be that treating information as a commons is sometimes the least bad solution. Something I haven't really gone into, because it's not part of this talk, is the whole question of what ought to be property. The mistake that non-economists make is to say property is just a silly arrangement in which there's a perfectly useful thing and I can't use it because it belongs to you. Wouldn't it be better to just have everything used by anybody who can use it? Economists tend to make the opposite mistake. They say, look, property is this wonderful institution for allocating resources, getting resources created, so everything should be property. And if you think about it for a while, if you're interested, I've got a chapter in my book Law's Order, which I think is even for sale out on Laissez Faire Bookstore, in which I discuss in some detail the question of property and why it makes sense that certain things are treated as property and certain things are not. And they're not treated as property when the costs of defining and enforcing property rights are high and the benefits are low, and they are the other way around. I think I'm out of time at this point, otherwise I'd go into more detail. Let me tell you all, though, I do have a website. My website is www.daviddfriedman.com. You do have to remember the middle initial. If I'd applied a few months earlier, I wouldn't have needed it. But daviddfriedman.com, and you can find quite a lot of stuff relevant to this. It also has a link to my blog, which I therefore won't give you the URL for, aside from not remembering it. And I generally, post between once a day and once a week, roughly, on whatever I'm thinking about. I mean, it's not guaranteed to be political or economic. It might be any of those things. Thank you. Yes. No.
Oh, okay.
That is probably...
I just read better than I...
Probably
listen,
most of the ideas are available in various of my written things.
Okay.
But this particular speech is one version of those ideas.